From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide and is available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. Just subscribe. It's free. At the intersection of religion, government, and politics, this week marked the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. As we look at the state of our nation today, we are morally obligated to separate the noise coming at us 24/7 from the truly important matters that deserve our attention. We face enormous challenges, but tough times are nothing new for this country. Barely 5 years after the brutal public murder of a beloved president, in the span of a few months in 1968, we lost the nation's leading voice on civil rights. And then the late president's brother, who was offering our nation hope despite our collective and his own personal losses, even as he was successfully running for the presidency himself. Despite the suffering our nation endured, suffering which fell so disproportionately on the most underprivileged and undervalued among us, America pulled through. And I pray it will do so again. But the noise and distractions are an essential weapon being used against us, no less effective than the fire hoses and National Guard snipers of earlier times. They are an essential part of remaking our nation in an image you and I would never recognize. And our moral imperative is to rise above that fog and do the work required to stay truly informed and to winnow truth from propaganda. Well, let's get at it. Now here's what's coming up on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Ever since the Supreme Court granted marriage equality nationwide, conservative activists have been searching for some way to push back against equality for LGBT people. And they found what they're looking for in some seemingly innocuous bills that look like they're meant to defend religious freedom or promote business opportunities. But really, they're hidden weapons pointed directly at queer people.
Even as ever broader religious exemptions are redefining the very nature of our pluralistic society, a recent academic study demonstrates that Americans who claim religious liberty privileges to discriminate do so no more frequently than Americans who want to discriminate for any other reason. That's right. With or without that excuse, the same percentage of our fellow citizens seem to simply want to live out their biases. We'll look at the chilling implications of these findings with researcher sociologist Landon Schnabel. Part of what makes interreligious activism so profoundly rewarding is seeing people come together across deep, ancient and deliberately maintained divisions, in spite of all odds, to celebrate peace, faith, and hope. One such inspiring initiative is coming up later this month, and you'll hear about Songs for the Holy City on this week's State of Belief Radio. But first,
the Supreme Court ruled in favor of a Colorado baker who refused to make a cake for a gay couple.
It's important to know what the court did not do here. It did not give a green light to business owners to discriminate on the basis of religion against members of the gay community or other protected individuals.
Last week, we promised a follow-up with author, activist, and attorney Rabbi Jay Michelson once the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision was handed down by the U.S. Supreme Court. What we didn't realize was that the decision would come so quickly after that promise was made. I'm happy to be joined once again by Jay Michelson here on State of Belief Radio. Jay, welcome back.
Thanks.
So Monday, the Supremes acted in exactly the way you had predicted. So describe that action, if you would.
Well, I think, you know, what I was saying, I think, and a lot of folks were thinking, is how Justice Kennedy was going to square the circle.
Mm-hmm.
He was really stuck between two commitments, on the one hand to LGBT equality, on the other hand to free speech. And I think what we didn't expect was how easy the Colorado Civil Rights Commission made it for him to do that.
Mm-hmm.
There were just, you know, too many statements in the record where the commission was not taking seriously the Baker's religious objections. And that's why this case was 7-2. That part was certainly a surprise. Because even two liberals, Justice Kagan and Justice Breyer, agreed that this you have to take people's religious beliefs seriously. You can't mm-hmm. say they're irrational or offensive. And with that in the record, they didn't have to take on any of the hard issues, and that left it to the concurring and dissenting opinions to write the case that we thought we were going to get.
Jay, I've seen this story covered in so many different ways. You wrote in the Daily Beast that this is not a loss for LGBTQ community. Talk about this, please.
Well, so, you know, I think we want to separate between the legal impact of the case and then kind of the political or public relations impact. On the legal side, not only was this not a setback, it actually was a step forward for LGBT folks, because even conservative justices signed on to an opinion that said that gay people have rights and need to be taken seriously and a lot of other things like that. This was a very narrow opinion, even narrower than we talked about last week. I think I said last week the best case scenario would be something very narrow that's just to the facts of this case.
Right.
And this opinion was so narrow that it said nothing. It said nothing that we don't already know. We already knew going in that the government has to be neutral to religious claims, that it can't be partial to one claim or another. And in this case, you know, given what the court found in the record, the Civil Rights Commission was not neutral. They were hostile to this person's religious claim.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you or I, we may have opinions. We may be hostile toward his religious claim, but we're not the government. We don't, you know, we're not bound by the First Amendment. The government can't say we like this religious belief and we don't like this other one. And that's why, you know, for folks like us, you know, who are still active in the faith community in one way or another, this is a good decision. It's not something that I actually disagree with. It's not appropriate for a government agency to say that somebody's religious beliefs are irrational. That's just not what governments should do. So, you know, that's the legal effect. Now, politically, you know, we've already seen a kind of ripple effect of, you know, various bigots saying no gays allowed, no blacks allowed already, just in this first week. And so there is a sense that this was a victory for the Baker, which technically speaking it was, but the sense is that, you know, now there's a license to discriminate. You know, that's just not true. And that guy who put up a no gays allowed sign in his store will be prosecuted if he doesn't take that sign down. That sign is illegal. It violates the non-discrimination laws in his state. And so the reality, I think, will set in soon enough. And I'm certain that the right knows this as well as the left. They can take their victory lap and be happy that they won, but they know as well as I did that they did not get what they wanted.
Jay, in your written commentary on the ruling, you pointed out that this was a politically significant ruling also. What do you mean by that?
Well, again, I think this is part of the culture war, and this is part of a large effort, which you and I have discussed many times, to basically do away with non-discrimination law piece by piece. There was a really good piece by an article by Louise Melling from the ACLU saying that maybe Obergefell, the same-sex marriage decision, is the new Roe versus Wade.
Hmm.
You know, Roe versus Wade is still on the books, but there are so many exemptions and limitations to the right to abortion that it's a shadow of what it was when it first came down. And that's the goal for same-sex marriage and LGBT equality in general. The cases may stay on the books, the laws may stay on the books, but with so many exemptions and so many kind of ways to avoid following that law, they become functionally meaningless.
So you say also that the ruling explicitly states that this decision is not a precedent for future lawsuits. So what's coming next?
So, you know, there are a number of these cases working their way through the system. There are cases for pharmacists who refuse to dispense birth control or now even contraception. There are cases with other wedding professionals, photographers, florists, people like that, who refuse to provide services for a same-sex wedding. Every one of those cases is in exactly the same place that it was last week. There's no new law that's in this case, that's in Masterpiece Cake Shop. So the only way we know those folks will win, the refusers, is if there's material in the record that shows that the government was actively hostile to their religious claim. But again, we knew that already. That's not new law. And again, that's why this was 7-2. You know, what you could do in terms of what's coming next is read the tea leaves of the other opinion.
Mm-hmm.
And if you break it down, it's actually pretty interesting. There were three justices, the conservative justices, who wrote that the baker should win no matter what. Even if there weren't those comments in the record, the baker should win. Then there were two liberal justices who said, nope, the baker should lose. Even with those comments in the record, the baker should lose. Two more justices said, well, the baker would lose if it weren't for those comments, right? That's Breyer and Kagan.
Mm-hmm.
So if you tally that up, that's four who say the baker should lose, three who say the baker should win, and then it's Roberts and Kennedy in the middle who didn't say one way or the other. So actually only two justices didn't take a substantive position, and what we have is sort of a 4-3-2 split in the court. So it's hard to, again, you don't want to read the tea leaves too much, but the center of the court did not reach the critical issues in this case.
Well, do high court decisions inevitably influence how other judges approach similar cases going forward, and what may happen there on this case?
So, and it may sound counterintuitive, but I actually think this case was a step forward for LGBT folks. And let's just take a look from like a 30,000-foot view. You know, as people of faith, we don't want the government or anyone else really to dismiss the claims of religious folks who are making claims. That's not how we want these cases to be decided. We actually want to have dialogue and a respectful dialogue, and we want there to be respect for people's religious claims. Now, he didn't make this up. Jack Phillips, the baker, didn't just make up his religious claim as a way to avoid serving gay people. He actually said he would sell them any other cake, just not a wedding cake. What we want to see is a respectful conversation where we say, all right, I get it. That's a sincere religious belief. But you have to render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. You've opened up a store in this country, in this state, and there's a non-discrimination law, and you have to find another way to accommodate your religious belief, which wouldn't be so hard for him to do. Right?
Mm-hmm.
He could just hire an apprentice baker for that one particular case, for cake. He wouldn't have to pay someone all the time. He could just have someone else bake the cake if he has a religious objection. There are a number of different ways that he could find a way to accommodate his religious beliefs and also obey the law. So that's the kind of result that I'd like to see in all of these other cases, whether it's the florist or the photographer or whomever, which is that you have to obey the same laws as everyone else. That's what I mean by render under Caesar what is Caesar's. You know, the early Christians did not want to use a coin that had a picture of Caesar on it. They saw that as idolatry. That was a valid religious belief. But, the answer was, no, that's not how it works. You obey the laws of the country where you're living, and you practice your religion in harmony with those laws.
Are there any remaining high-profile SCOTUS decisions that we're still waiting for? I'm interested in what's likely to happen in cases involving Muslim Americans, for example.
You know, there was actually a really interesting think piece connecting the dots between Masterpiece Cake Shop and the travel ban case.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So one of the things that Masterpiece Cake Shop said very, very clearly is the government cannot be hostile to a religious belief. Everybody agreed with that, liberals, conservatives, everybody. You know, now we have a case coming up sometime in the next 3 weeks where the government, and in particular the president, is obviously hostile toward religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. Right? Putting a ban in place that, you know, they've tried to decorate it and say, well, it's not a Muslim ban, but, you know, you can't run away from what the president said on the campaign trail, which is, we want a Muslim ban. Mm-hmm. And then to make matters even worse, he said, well, we just found a way to make the Muslim ban legal. Which, you know, I'm laughing because that's just that's ridiculous. So if you put these cases together, if the court is really going to be serious about respecting religious beliefs as they are in Masterpiece Cake Shop, then what about in Trump versus Hawaii, which is the travel ban case? Mm-hmm. So I think that's one really interesting angle to think about the impact of this case. It's less about LGBT folks and more about the government and how it acts toward religion. Hmm. So that's the biggest one, the travel ban case. There are a couple of also very important voting cases and a really important privacy case. So people like me are going to have a really busy month of June.
Hmm. Jay, to the best of your knowledge, is there even a chance that the current lineup of the Supreme Court stays unchanged until a year before the 2020 election? And obviously, I am assuming the Garland rule would be invoked after that, blocking any Trump nominee the way Barack Obama's last nominee was blocked.
Well, that last point depends entirely on who's in charge of the Senate. I can promise you that if the Republicans are in charge of the Senate, that rule will suddenly disappear, and they will confirm, they will rubber stamp whoever Trump puts on the Supreme Court or any other court for that matter. That rule isn't worth the paper that it's not written on, because it's not even a written rule. They just kind of made it up. So, yeah, we have to go all the way, I think, to 2020. Yeah, look, there's a chance. I think everybody is taking bets as to whether Justice Kennedy is planning to retire or not. He may well. He may wait another year. Everybody is also, all of the left is begging him to just stick it out for one more year, at least until there could be a Democratic Senate in 2019. You know, it would be interesting, I think, hypothetically, if Justice Kennedy were to retire this summer, that rule that you just mentioned would suddenly matter a lot. Mm-hmm. Right? So now there's 6 months left of the existing Senate. Suppose Justice Kennedy, you know, retires next month. Theoretically, if the Senate obeys that rule, they shouldn't take up a nomination until the new Senate is in. Hmm. But they're not going to do that. They're going to rubber stamp whoever Trump puts up. So, you know, this is one of the least interesting betting games, because it's just not known. And we don't really know. And I think, yes, to answer your question clearly, yes, there is a chance that the current lineup stays in place. That depends on everybody's health, and it depends on Justice Kennedy's decision.
Dr. Jay Michelson is a rabbi, an author, activist, and an attorney who writes prolifically for The Daily Beast, The Forward, and other leading publications. Jay is an affiliated assistant professor at Chicago Theological Seminary, and his books range from The Essential God Versus Gay, The Religious Case for Equality, to The Gate of Tears, Sadness, and The Spiritual Path. Jay, once again, thank you for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Elton.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. Sociologist Landon Schnabel will explain research that shows something quite ugly about religious exemption rhetoric being used to institutionalize discrimination. And later, Songs for the Holy City. I'll talk with Imam Abdullah Antepli. I'm Welton Getty. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. The research article is titled Denial of Service to Same-Sex and Interracial Couples, Evidence from a National Survey Experiment. Published late last year, it has received renewed interest as the nation prepared for the Supreme Court's Masterpiece Cake Shop decision. And joining me right now is one of the authors, sociologist Landon Schnabel. Landon, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, I'm happy to be here.
What were you trying to determine with this research?
We were just trying to figure out why it is that people support refusal of services and whether the conditions under which they would support it vary. So, for example, are people more likely to support refusal if it's a self-employed individual refusing services or if it's a corporation refusing services? One of the things we were most interested in was whether people would support refusal for non-religious reasons. So religious freedom has been the kind of key part of this discussion, but we wanted to see, is the situation being a kind of a potential case of religious liberty, so someone's refusing for religious reasons, do people only support refusal when it's in that condition, or would they also support refusal if someone just, you know, wanted to refuse services and it was not a case of religious freedom?
I'll ask you to describe what you and your co-authors found.
So we found people were about twice as likely to support refusal by an individual than by a corporation. So overall, 61% of people supported refusal when it was a self-employed individual refusing services, and only 31% supported refusal when it was a corporation. And for the listeners who may not know about what we asked in the study, we asked about a specific scenario. We described a situation in which a photographer refuses services to either a same-sex couple or an interracial couple, and then we asked whether that business should have been able to refuse services or whether they should have had to provide services. So we found people are about twice as likely to support refusal by a self-employed individual than by a corporation. Some of the other findings were more surprising, though. We found about the same level of support for refusal, regardless of whether it was for a religious reason or for a not religious reason. So we described the person refusing services and them saying that it was either a religious refusal, or we described them saying that the person explicitly is not religious and it's not a religious reason for refusal, but they disagreed with the type of couple who was coming in to get services. We found that about the same level of support, statistically the same, for support for refusal for religious reasons versus for non-religious reasons. We also found that people were a little bit more likely to support refusal to a gay couple than to an interracial couple, but the difference was not as large as we were expecting. So we found that 53% said that a gay couple should be able to be refused services, and 39% said an interracial couple should be able to refuse services, despite race being a protected class.
Okay, so how does that expose religious conscience arguments as disingenuous?
Yeah, so we found that religion matters, but it primarily matters among the respondents themselves. So respondents who were more likely to be evangelical or respondents who themselves opposed same-sex marriage or interracial marriage, they were more likely to support refusal. But surprisingly, they were just as likely to support refusal for non-religious reasons as for religious reasons. So it seems that there's something going on with people's own beliefs shaping their view of the situation, but they don't really seem to care if it's a religious refusal or a non-religious refusal. They're just as likely to support it either way.
What made you and your collaborators want to address this extremely loaded issue? Did you have some hunch of what you were going to find?
Honestly, we thought religious freedom was going to matter. We thought that it was going to be a key, important component here. And we were expecting very little support for refusal for non-religious reasons, but we did just want to see, you know, to what extent is this really about religious freedom? We thought that it would be, but surprisingly, it doesn't really seem to matter very much.
So you really were surprised by the results of what you found.
Yeah, I mean, when we first started looking through the data, we thought there must be something wrong. So maybe maybe some people are just as likely to support it for non-religious reasons as for religious reasons. So we started looking at different groups. So, for example, we thought evangelicals. Evangelicals must be more likely to support refusal for religious reasons than non-religious reasons. We found that wasn't the case. We thought, okay, maybe people who attend religious services frequently are more likely to support refusal for religious reasons than non-religious reasons. Again, not the case. We looked across all different types of groups, and we could not identify any group who was more likely to support refusal for religious reasons than non-religious reasons to gay couples. We actually asked people open-ended questions, too, to let them describe the reasons for why they supported refusal or not. And we asked each person only about one scenario. So one person would have only been asked about a religious reason or a non-religious reason, and we randomly assigned people to get these scenarios. And people were equally likely to give a response, regardless of the situation, of a religious reason versus a non-religious reason. But they were just as likely among the corporation versus self-employed conditions to give the same types of responses. We found, though, that people used different types of justifications in their argument. So if we had presented a scenario in which someone had refused for religious reasons, they maybe would have mentioned religion in their response. They would have said, oh, well, anyone should be able to practice their religion in a business. But we may have asked another person who supported refusal, and it was a non-religious reason for support, and they would have maybe given us some sort of libertarian justification. So we got a lot of people saying stuff like, a business should be able to refuse anyone for any reason regardless, and the market will sort things out. We also found, though, that people who were more likely to personally oppose same-sex marriage were much more likely to support refusal. So we kind of found that people's own views towards, you know, the situation itself and whether they themselves would have been likely to support refusal, that was basically what seemed to drive whether they were okay with a business refusing services. So it didn't really matter about what that business was doing, whether they were doing religious reasons or not. It was more about the person's own beliefs and whether they thought that that couple was something that they agree or disagree with.
Tell us the nature of the people that you got your numbers from.
So we had a nationally representative sample. We had over 2,000 people that we talked to. So we had people who were of all different age groups, all different faith groups, different levels of education, different races. So we had kind of this cross-section of America that was nationally representative of what the American population would be. We looked at different types of groups. Some people were more likely to support refusal than others. So, for example, as we maybe would expect based on the kind of national debate on these issues, Republicans were more likely to support refusal than were Democrats. But interestingly, Republicans were just as likely to support refusal for non-religious reasons as for religious reasons.
So for non-scholars, what does this reveal about the entire religious conscience movement?
So what this kind of reveals is that it's not really about religious freedom. Religious freedom seems to be the justification that people use to justify something that they would agree with regardless. So someone might say, oh, this is a religious reason for refusal, therefore it's justified, but they would be just as likely to support it for a non-religious reason. But either way, the debate is right now about religious freedom. So should people, for religious reasons, be able to refuse services? But what we found is that there's a good number of Americans out there who would say that it's fine to refuse services for any reason. Some even say that it's fine to refuse services to an interracial couple. In fact, under one condition, so when an individual refuses services for religious reasons, we found just as high support for refusal to interracial couples as we found for support for refusal to gay couples.
What would you say is happening here?
Thankfully, we had this qualitative data. So we asked people to explain their answers, and we looked through these answers in detail, and we found there's kind of two key issues here. So one is people's views towards same-sex marriage. People who oppose same-sex marriage are much more likely to support refusal to a gay couple. So, for example, when an individual refuses services to a gay couple, among those who oppose same-sex marriage, 90% say that it was acceptable to make that refusal. Interestingly, though, 50% who support same-sex marriage would say that refusal by an individual is okay. We wanted to understand why that was the case. We looked through the data, and we found very commonly this kind of libertarian response. So people would say a business should be able to refuse services to anyone for any reason. Some people who, especially those who support same-sex marriage and still said that refusal would be okay, they would say, I disagree with what this business did, but a business should be able to do whatever they want, and the market will sort things out. So there were a lot of people who thought, if a business discriminates, therefore other people will hear about it, they will stop going there, and the market will take care of and kind of put out of business discriminatory businesses. I don't necessarily think that would be the case. We can look through history and see that legal protections were required to end refusal of services to racial minorities. But we can see that among the American public, there's quite a few people who kind of want the government to stay out of what a business is doing.
How do you see what's coming?
So there's lots of different things that could happen. In this particular case, support for same-sex marriage continues to increase. And as that continues to increase, I suspect that support for refusal will decline. There's also different trends out there, and people's understanding varies about whether or not the market can take care of things or whether we need the government to intervene. And there's different views on religious freedom. So religious freedom, in one sense, is the freedom to practice and believe as one sees fit. sees fit, and to not have the government intervene. But this seems to be a case where people are wanting to kind of take their religion into the public sphere and are kind of wanting to affect others with their own religious beliefs. And that's a type of religious freedom that I think is going to be more contentiously debated in the public sphere. I think most people would agree that people should be able to practice their religion as they see fit. But the question is, should they be able to practice their religion as they see fit if it's affecting other groups, especially marginalized and minority groups?
And as you look at the data and what's coming, as you just described, what is, if you have recommendations, what are the recommendations you have for dealing with this issue in the future?
So a challenge that we see here is that it appears that much of the American public actually supports refusal on the basis of race. We were surprised by this. It's actually illegal to refuse on the basis of race, but many Americans support refusal to interracial couples. Not very many people oppose interracial marriage, but about 10% of Americans we found said they opposed interracial marriage. And among those, the vast majority said that a business should be able to refuse services to an interracial couple. Thankfully, though, we have laws in place that kind of balance out that situation, so it's actually illegal to refuse services on the basis of race. It may be that sexuality needs to be a protected class so that we can make sure that this particular minority group kind of receive some of the same protections that other minority groups have already received in the past.
I want you to judge my own perspective on what you've just told us. We're in a situation now where the Constitution seems to be under attack in a lot of different ways. If we go with what seems to be the overwhelming attitudes that you found, am I wrong in saying that really does threaten the Constitution and the rights it wants to give to us?
Yeah, so, I mean, a lot of Americans out there said things that they were concerned that the rights that are given to people are under threat if they are being refused services. If people aren't treated the same, that means that different Americans are being different opportunities and different experiences. So there definitely seems to be kind of an opinion out there that the Constitution or constitutional rights are kind of the rights that people have as human beings are just kind of threatened or challenged. There's a lot of different opinions out there among the public, and I definitely think that the freedoms of individuals to be able to get services are an important part of what we understand as Americans. So I think we recognize that refusal of service to racial minorities was wrong, that they should have the same rights as other Americans, that their constitutional rights as humans, as Americans, were kind of devalued if they were being refused services. And I think that some of the principles from that situation could be kind of projected to this situation. And a lot of Americans did see quite a few similarities between the experiences of different racial or sexual or different types of minority groups.
Landon Schnabel is a Ph.D. candidate in sociology at Indiana University, together with Brian Powell and Lauren Apgar. Landon authored the eye-opening research report titled Denial of Service to Same-Sex and Interracial Couples, Evidence from a National Survey Experiment. We'll link to that report from stateofbelief.com. Landon, this is a terribly intriguing report that you've got, and we appreciate you sharing it with us today and helping us understand some of the consequences of it. Thanks for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
And thank you for inviting me. It was great talking with you.
Imam Abdullah Antepli was the first Muslim chaplain at Duke University, where he now serves as chief representative of Muslim affairs, as well as adjunct faculty of Islamic studies, teaching a number of courses on Islam. He will be taking part in a unique interfaith event coming up on June 20th in New York City, And I am very happy that the occasion brings Imam Tepley back to State of Belief Radio. Man, it's good to hear from you again. Thanks for being with us on State of Belief again.
Glad to be back.
Please talk about what Songs for the Holy City at Jewish Theological Seminary in New York City is all about, if you would.
It's a broader effort to bring the best of religion into this long, bloody, discouraging, toxic conflict which has been going on in the Middle East for about a century or so. Regretfully, most of those efforts to bring peace has been mostly, and with all due respect to them, by secular parties, diplomats, governments, dealing with this issue as if it is a political, purely and exclusively political conflict. It's a real state issue. Whereas at the heart of this conflict, it is a political issue.
Mm-hmm.
But at the heart of it is also a deeply religious component to it. And for the most part, both Judaism, Christianity, and Islam has deep attachments to that part of the land. It is part of our scripture. It is part of our religious imaginations. And so far, we weren't able to tap into that potential source of religion, our theologies, to become a force and source of peace, reconciliation, harmony. Regretfully, often religion has been abused and used to be a source of bloodshed, conflict, hate, prejudice, and violence on all sides. So this is a modest attempt, a renewed commitment and motivation to bring that potential force in religion. If it is utilized, it can also be a source of incredible force of healing, unity, and reconciliation.
Hmm. Abdullah, who are the other faith leaders and musicians that are taking part in this concert?
Well, for those who will be attending, you are up for an incredible feast. There is really a very broad spectrum of religious leaders. Musicians are involved. Myself, I will be flying up to New York for this particular event. And my dear colleague and friend, who have been a dear, dear mentor of mine, Rabbi Tamar Applebaum,
mm-hmm.
She, for those who know the landscape, for a woman to be a rabbi in Israel is not an easy task. She is not officially recognized by the official religious establishment in Israel. But despite and against all odds, she continues to be an incredible voice of compassion. Mm-hmm. And in her presence, often I feel the presence of God. She's a very special person. She lost her brother in a conflict there, and she turned that incredible pain and channeled into an engagement. She is in the forefront of the Israeli society in Jerusalem, engaging with ultra-Orthodox religious Jews, Palestinians within Israel, and Palestinian brothers and sisters in West Bank as well. We will be the two main speakers, but in addition, there are Christian, Jewish, Muslim musicians, poets will be performing throughout the night.
Mm. Well, I know how busy you are and how many interests that you have. So this must be a really important project for you. What made you feel like I got to do this, whether I have other times to do it or not? I've got to do this.
Thank you so very much. I often feel 24 hours is not enough for a day.
Uh-huh.
And I just sent gentle complaints to God Almighty. I wish we had more hours in the day.
Mm.
I did choose this event over many other commitments because it really embodies multiple callings of mine. One, my essential calling as a Muslim American imam in the United States to be the helpful voice and faith of my beautiful religion and my tradition, and for 5 million of fellow American Muslim citizens living in this country, to never miss an opportunity. Look for any platform where we can be a helpful voice and an image for fellow Americans to understand Islam as a religion and Muslims as people. It is no secret after 9/11 and ongoing events, especially in the last couple of weeks, the headlines about Islam and Muslims, news agencies, coverage of our faith tradition, and even our fellow Muslims. It is regretful. For example, yesterday, our president hosted an iftar meal at the White House.
Mm-hmm.
And unlike many other iftar events since President Bill Clinton, the focus was American Islam and American Muslims. This one wasn't, and for the most part, our voice was missing in many of the media outlets. So I missed no opportunity to fulfill that responsibility as an American and as a Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
In this day and age, when people are struggling, when their anti-Muslim bigotry and anti-Muslim hate and prejudice is rising, I think we all have a responsibility to reach out to those people if their news agencies are not covering our voice. It's not covering the moderate Muslim voice.
Mm-hmm.
We have to go where people are. And secondly, one of my central calling in life, to heal and unite our wounded and polarized communities between Jews and Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever is going on in Israel and in Palestine, and the recent developments of our embassy moving to Jerusalem, and indefensible civilian casualties, killings of Palestinians in Gaza, and the ongoing tragedy and human suffering in Gaza is adding to that division, polarization between Jews and Muslims all around the world, including the United States. So if you Google my name, you will see most of my work is to reconcile Jewish-Muslim relations, look for opportunities where we can build bridges between our communities. Even if we can't do anything about the Middle East, as fellow Americans, American Jews and American Muslims, we have a strong sense of responsibility to show the world how a reconciled, healthy, a little bit more sophisticated, meaningful, civil Jewish-Muslim relations would look like in North America, because in North America there are things that's possible that is not possible anywhere else.
Mm.
Therefore, we should pay attention to that responsibility and do whatever we can. So this event not only brings the best of Islam through art and music and its attachment to Jerusalem, what Jerusalem means for Muslim theology, Muslim imagination, but also it has a very central mission to become a modest step in reconciling Jewish-Muslim relations in North America.
I know it must be frustrating for you to see something done like the iftar at the White House, something done that claims to be about all Muslims, and it really doesn't represent that. So here you're doing a concert. It's hard to come up against a bully pulpit, but you're coming up against it with a unique event. What do you hope people who attend this concert will get out of it?
Well, multiple things. One, I think the toxicity and the polarization of the current political climate over Israeli-Palestinian conflict, our political situation here, it is excruciating. It is pumping despair and hopelessness to the hearts and minds of many fellow Americans. The first thing, I really would like to see this event pumping hope, inspiration, commitment, and motivation to do good in the world, despite all the ugliness, despite all the despair-pumping, hopelessness-spraying events happening. We have to create these islands and centers of hope, and not a superficial hope, not a naive hope, a hope that could be based on real action. There is a way in which if the community building, relationship partnership building efforts are efficiently done and scaled up, we can turn things around. So I want to really combat the increasing culture of hopelessness, pessimism, because we cannot give in to hopelessness. We haven't faced all these problems that we are facing for the first time. If you look at the human history doesn't go on linear fashion only down or only up. It always goes ups and downs. If you are experiencing some downs, our previous historical rise, our historical bouncing back from, say, civil rights movements, our relative success in defeating anti-Semitism, the way in which we welcomed Jews, Catholics, and other minorities to our society, should give us a hope that even though temporarily, if we may shy away from those foundational commitments of inclusivity, love, compassion, welcome, and pluralism, we will ultimately bounce back. I want to give that kind of hope and commitment, and I want this event to model and exemplify and also amplify that message of reasonable, constructive hope against despair and hopelessness. Secondly, in our ability to bounce back and build an ethical, moral society, I think our biggest problem is not evil people, not angry people, not terrorists. They are a problem. But I think the biggest challenge is the apathy of the regular, moderate people, people of all faith, of no faith. If you are not paying attention, if you are not taking action, if you are not doing your part in a civic duty by getting engaged, in a moral duty by doing what you can do, that means you are part of the problem. In the context of civil rights movements, famously, Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel said, there are few people guilty of all the problems that we are facing, but all of us are responsible. I want to, this event, in everything I do, I want to bring that spirit of, that sense of responsibility that we have to get up, wake up from our slumber, and constantly assigning guilt into those crazies and bad people. Bad things happen not only because of bad people. Bad things happen because the good people are not active. They are apathetic. They are lazy. They are not as generous, as committed as those ideologically driven, zealous people. So first thing I want as a result of this event to come out is hope. The second is, as a result of this event and everything that I do, I want people to transform and evolve themselves from lazy moderates of any faith or no faith into radical peacemakers, radical citizens who are doing everything they can to stop eroding values of American civic culture and American society.
You know, the question I want to ask you right now is if you will talk with me again soon, because I've got four or five really important questions about what we're talking about that I need to hear you answer, and we're not going to have time to do it.
As you know, I never say no to these meaningful conversations, but invite me for an hour. Let's have an extended conversation, and I welcome your audience to also connect with us through email or phone and ask those questions to us. As well, we say in Arabic, ahlan wa sahlan, anytime.
Good. There's so much noise in today's 24-hour news cycle and social media jungle. I'd like to ask you about your practice in sorting out what is important from what is merely loud, and where then do you find hope in this difficult time?
As a person of faith, my hope, my rock is my God, God of all nations. And that God intervened in the history of humanity, sometimes in miraculous ways, sometimes in mundane ways. I believe God's ultimate goal is not to create perfect religions. God's ultimate goal was to create perfect ethical, moral human beings. Religions only have utilitarian values to provide that ethical moral framework to become an ethical moral ideal human being. So I believe as God intervened in the history and provided that forceful interventions, I believe we will bounce back again. And we will connect to that message as Christians, Jews, Buddhists, Hindus, and of people of no faith. Because essentially, innate good in humanity is my only hope.
One last question about the concert. Am I correct that it's going to be streamed live on the internet?
That's correct. But nothing like being in the room. So for all my friends who will be in town in New York, I am just welcoming them. I hope you will join us and we will burst into joy as we celebrate and pray for that holy city.
Imam Abdullah Antepli is the former Muslim chaplain at Duke University, where he now serves as chief representative of Muslim affairs, as well as adjunct faculty of Islamic studies. teaching a number of courses in Islam.
Kareem, to your Muslim listeners, and I congratulate them for upcoming Eid in a week or so.
Thank you so much for being with us again today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, my friend.
Now, before we go, early in today's show, we acknowledge the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Robert F. Kennedy. That's been on my mind heavily this past week. I remember this event as if it were yesterday. And also remember the night Bobby Kennedy stood in front of a mostly African-American crowd with the terrible responsibility of telling them that Martin Luther King Jr. had just been killed. The situation was one in which anger, chaos, and even violence could have erupted quickly. With extemporaneous words, Bobby Kennedy calmed the crowd with comments as relevant today as they were on that sad evening. Here's what Kennedy said. What we need in the United States is not division. What we need in the United States is not hatred. What we need in the United States is not violence and lawlessness, but is love and wisdom and compassion toward one another and a feeling of justice toward those who still suffer within our country, whether they be white or whether they be black. According to Charles Pierce, no politician since that night ever has spoken so frankly about the power of love and compassion in politics. My friends, it's time for another such courageous patriot to step forward. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.